So I'd just like to thank all my panelists for attending today. First of all, we'll be speaking James Turley of the Communist Party of Great Britain. And second, we'll have Joseph Green of Communist Voice, who has been an activist in the communist movement since 1969. And since 1995, he has been editor of the journal Communist Voice, which opposes both Stalinism and Trotskyism, upholds Leninist views on anti-imperialism and party building. And finally, we have Larry Everest, who writes for Revolution Paper and has reported from Iran, Iraq, Palestine, and India. He is the author of Oil, Power, and Empire, Iraq and the US Global Agenda, and Behind the Poison Cloud, Union Carbide's Oil Power Massacre. In 1991, Everest shot the award-winning video, Iraq, War Against the People, and in 2005 testified before the World Tribunal on Iraq in Istanbul. So I'll just read the short introduction that the panel organizers put together when we were trying to think through this question of how does the left understand imperialism today. 10 years on from the US invasion of Iraq, are we any closer to understanding what imperialism is and why we are against it? The problem of imperialism seems to be getting more difficult to clarify in relation to our present moment. Since the euphoria around the Arab Spring has passed, the left has had mixed responses to the interventionist foreign policy of the US, UK, and France in the Middle East and North Africa. It is difficult to disentangle and to clarify what relation the left's responses to current issues in Libya, Mali, and Syria bear on the history of anti-imperialism. Nevertheless, if we are to ever overcome imperialism, we must also confront the history of the left's attempts to overcome it. Just over 30 years ago, the Falklands War presented problems for the left in terms of being, on the one hand, against imperialism of British intervention, on the other hand, against a brutal military dictatorship in Argentina. Anti-fascism and anti-imperialism have not always been an ideological conflict on the left, but it could be argued that they have increasingly become so. If this is the case, it might suggest a changing character of anti-imperialism during the 20th century. Looking further back to World War I, what did Marxists understand by the term imperialism? Does being anti-imperialist today even mean to be anti-capitalist? Does being anti-capitalist mean to be anti-imperialist? In asking what is imperialism and for what reasons are you against it, this panel is attempting to address what does it mean to be Marxist and what does it mean to be on the left today? It is also to ask what has become of the left and conversely, what could it become? Okay, so I'll begin with 10 minutes from James.
Okay, thanks for inviting me. So, in that sense, diving right, I mean, imperialism poses a series of problems to us as Marxists, and they can broadly be divided into theoretical problems and political problems. The theoretical problems is simply that there is transparently obvious that the global order is characterized by very sharp inequality between different states. And this is as much a feature of the global order as very obvious inequality and exploitative relations between classes. And moreover, that this form, arrangement, as it were, has serious effects on how the class struggle itself plays out in different countries. It also poses a problem which I'll be talking about, I guess, quite a lot, the issue of kind of the historical periodization of capitalism. imperialism represents a particular stage of capitalism or some such, and generally where it's going. Even if imperialism isn't a particular stage, it still tells us, it's still in a sense a sort of carbon dating mechanism, you'd say. Political problems is simply that this arrangement that I argued at the plenary yesterday, that the state is in some way a sort of a central organisation of political power and relations between classes, and it's clear that in terms of imperialism as a global system of unequal relations between states is the way that state power is organised globally. So in that sense, it is the paramount of many political problems facing us as Marxists and revolutionaries. If you want, in that sense, to overthrow capitalism globally, then this is, you know, the very fact that this is, in a sense, the highest level of state power is a serious political challenge to us. In more kind of narrow terms, as the introduction pointed out, there is the issue of the attitude that we take to wars of stronger states against weaker states, and indeed vice versa, and beyond that, forms of quite soft war, like sanctions, which then feel very soft if you're being starved as a result. But there's another issue which has come up, particularly in the last 10 years, but really has been nagging us, at least since the early days of the Commentary, actually, which is the attitude that we take to forces which are not, strictly speaking, of the left, but then end up confronting imperialist powers in military conflict or otherwise. And this has kind of caused some serious divisions on the left. So the guidebook, in that sense, kind of how we've traditionally dealt with this as a movement is Lenin. Lenin's Imperialism, the High Stage of Capitalism, which is a sort of brief and fairly empirical analysis of the nature of imperialism. But in a sense, before we have to get there, before we even get there, the background to this is that there is a lot, much larger debate in the Second International about colonial policy and imperialism that took place starting in about 1896. And Karl Kautsky, who was the foremost leader of the Second International, came up with the effectively in a series of articles called Socialism and Colonial Policy, argued that effectively early modern empires, Spanish, Portuguese, Dutch, and so forth, were effectively pre-capitalist in nature, and did not kind of export capitalist relations of production, but was simply kind of rough, absolutist exploitation operations. This gives way with the ascent of England as an imperial power to what he calls Manchesterism. And this is the imperialism free trade, as it were. So instead of having a rough and brutal, this is Kautsky, obviously not true. But instead of having brutal colonial operations, what you have is bringing down trade barriers and expansion of capitalism as a system. And he's writing about 1896, 1897, by which point it's clear that, you know, the mechanisms towards what would become World War I are accelerating, and German states has attempted to found colonies and so forth. And Kautsky's argument is that this sort of scramble for Africa and all these things are expressions of pre-capitalist forces in Germany and in other states. And they're actually, in that sense, reactionary with regard to Manchesterism. Lenin breaks radically with the final part of that periodization, but keeps the other two bits effectively on board. He argues that imperialism is the highest stage of capitalism. That with the acceleration of the concentration of forced production and in terms of monopolies and what he calls finance capital, which he takes from Hilferding, the fusion of industrial capital and banking capital, that this is absolutely tied in with the need to sort of find external markets for capital and export capital. And he argues that previous to this period that empires, that sort of imperial powers exported commodities rather than capital. He also argues quite famously that this is the ground for the emergence of reformism in the workers' movement, because a layer of the working class is then bribed with the super profits of gained from imperialism. My view is that this is, you know, ultimately not an adequate account. Manchesterism never existed. And inasmuch as Britain promoted free trade, it was because Britannia ruled the waves, as we like to sing on our side of the pond, and so benefited from free trade policies because we controlled the trade routes. So it was actually it was an expression of the British dominance. But of course, we all know, certainly in India, the brutality of the colonial project and so forth. All that stuff didn't go away. the kind of political economic point is capital is exported on a large scale in that period as well. It's not a novel thing in the 1860s, 1890s, and so forth. In fact, it goes back even further now, as I'll get to. The labour aristocracy explanation, or the particular mechanism that Lennon says about the labour aristocracy, doesn't explain the emergence of mass reformist parties in Latin America, say, or anywhere else that isn't an imperial power. You know, where is Brazil's super profits that is bribing the Workers' Party with? Well, I don't see them. So I would argue, on the other hand, instead of that, that imperialism isn't a stage of capitalism, but is of underlying fundamental dynamic, which goes hand in hand with the rise of capitalist state regimes at all. If you look at the first of capitalist state regimes, or the Italian city-states, the Renaissance, they immediately acquire colonies and export capital to the colonies to set up sugar plantations, which are run by slaves. The export of capital goes back to the 15th century an inherent part of the operation of capitalist states. As soon as bourgeois state regimes are set up in Holland and in Portugal and other early modern empires, not all early modern empires are capitalists, by the way. The Spanish Empire simply reproduces feudalism and doesn't gel together in the same way. But many of the early modern empires, like the Dutch and so forth, precisely colonialism, plantations, export of capital, the expansion into India is tied up with the British expansion into India is tied up with export of capital, building of railways, cotton farms, which are tied in with the northwest, the high industry in the northwest of England, and so on. Going beyond that, there is a tendency for hegemonic states to arise that are dominant in terms of the world order, because capitalism needs a state to even reproduce itself in any meaningful sense. It equally needs some kind of means of international kind of coercion to enforce international trade. Capitalism is fundamentally an international mode of production. You have the Dutch supremacy is supplanted by British supremacy. This is the project of being hegemonic in this respect leads ultimately to kind of one way or another to sort of hypertrophy of the military and also of financial capital, as it were, which then leads to problems of overstretch and decline. And the thing of what Lenin interprets as the kind of terminal stage of capitalism, that he's absolutely correct. The global order is breaking down, but what's happening, and what is clear has happened from subsequent history, is that British hegemony is being supplanted by American hegemony. And it's clear now that the kind of, I would say, the US dominance has peaked, although it's not going away anytime soon. And it's clear from the actual outcomes of the Iraq or the Afghanistan war, which is simply chaos. I mean, I was sitting with a comrade earlier reading a letter from a Pakistani comrade about simply the decay of that society. It's not something the Afghanistan has been destroyed, but Pakistan is on the verge of becoming a failed state. And this is the pattern, at least in Somalia. Somalia barely exists as a state anymore after 20 years of being messed around. So in terms of the kind of the conclusions we draw from that, it is a political necessity for us to disrupt imperialist activity, and it will inevitably, as long as we have capitalism, we will have these kinds of problems. It doesn't matter who the top dog happens to be at a particular time, it is the US at the moment. But this will be a mechanism for the imposition of capitalist order. So in that sense, the final question, yes, to be anti-capitalist is to be anti-imperialist. We're going to be strict about both terms. The other side to it is that because there precisely isn't a hard division simply between the imperialist countries and semi-colonial countries, they're obviously countries far way up the pecking order and way down, but there is always an interest in finding and jostling for position within this kind of global order, which has the consequence that the contradiction between, say, the bourgeoisie or, you know, if there is a bourgeoisie in Afghanistan, I mean, God only knows, and the bourgeoisie of America is nowhere near as acute as the actual endogenous class conflicts within the country itself, between the classes. There isn't a division which Lenin's theory leads us to expect between a patriotic, as it were, bourgeoisie, as the Stalinists used to call it, or something of that kind, and a comprador class. Actually, there is a little bit of comprador in all these forces, just being borne out again and again by the course of kind of nationalist struggles and so forth. So it's incorrect to in that sense just big up whoever happens to be fighting the US at the time, because it cannot be favorable. It is impossible for them to be consistently anti-imperialist, and eventually the disaster will result. And I'll finish there.
Thank you. Okay, Joseph.
Hi. I'm the editor of Communist Voice, and since you're not available, since you're not familiar with Communist Voice, let me just remark that the literature table in the back on the left side, there's some Communist Voice. And there's also a handout here with a list of articles relevant to the subject, which you can find on the internet on Communist Voice. So, the struggles of the Arab Spring have led some to ask, should we side with anti-imperialism, or should we back the anti-fascist struggle? But this is a false dichotomy. There is neither real anti-imperialism or real anti-fascism without the masses. I would call such supposed anti-imperialism non-class anti-imperialism, or would-be anti-imperialism that attributes everything to maneuvers of this or that Western power or corporation, but somehow misses what's going on among the masses. Non-class anti-imperialism is very widespread in the left. Over the last few decades, it has repeatedly degenerated into support for oppressive tyrannies, prettification of new imperialisms, and despair at the prospects of mass struggle. Some groups even regard the Taliban as waging an anti-imperialist struggle in Afghanistan. All this has threatened to discredit anti-imperialism in the eyes of millions of people. The non-class anti-imperialists argue that once a regime comes into contradiction with the U.S. government, even such a regime that has worked closely with U.S. imperialism before, then the internal situation in that country is irrelevant. It argues that, didn't Lenin say in his article, Socialism and War, that it didn't matter who attacked first, India or Britain, that it would be a war of aggression on Britain's part and a war of defense on India's? Was there any reference there to the internal situation in India? But Lenin argued that a great revolutionary wave was spreading across India and elsewhere in Asia, a gigantic movement which imperialism was seeking to suppress. Millions among millions and millions of oppressed people were standing up against old social relations and national oppression, and this has been going on for decades. War was the continuation of politics by other means. So since a movement of liberation was taking place in India and elsewhere, since the long-standing issue was the democratic movement in India and the fight against colonialism, any war should be judged in that light. In that light, such things as who struck first was not particularly relevant. So the issue today is what is the long-standing situation of decades that has led to the Arab Spring and such things as the uprising against Gaddafi and the Assad regime? Except the people of the region are standing up to demand a say in their lives. The situation now is different from the revolutionary wave in the immediate years after World War II. Then in the Middle East, there were a series of struggles that brought colonies to independence or overthrew monarchies. In some countries, working class parties fought for influence. These struggles changed the face of the Middle East and North Africa and brought economic development, albeit it was capitalist modernization. But in country after country, the resulting governments became long-lasting dictatorships that humiliated the working people and destroyed their organizations or made these organizations into adjuncts of the government of the ruling bourgeoisie. These governments spoke in terms of the old ideals and aspirations of the people, and even in terms of socialism. But the old revolutionary movement was dead. Typical of the reality of these countries is that the supposedly anti-imperialist regimes in Syria and Libya cooperated with U.S. and British imperialism in the torture of each other's prisoners. What's going on today is neither a recolonization of the region nor a struggle with an anti-imperialist banner. It's the masses seeking the right to breathe in their own countries. It is not the result of the outside manipulation of foreign powers, although these powers are all seeking to either smash the movement or use it to their interest. But no upsurge against these regimes could have succeeded without the outside powers and imperialists being divided among themselves. Perhaps this would make it appear that we're facing a wave of democratic revolutions in the Middle East, like those sweeping Asia earlier. But this is not so. We are facing important struggles that may end the decades of political stagnation, but no matter how bitter and protracted the fighting, they are not democratic social revolutions of the old type. What is taking place in the Arab world are democratizations or liberalizations, as took place in the Philippines with the downfall of the Marcos dictatorship, as took place in Mexico with the end of the one-party rule of the PRI, as took place in Eastern Europe and Russia with the downfall of state capitalism. These are revolutions in a narrow sense, but in these countries, capitalist development had generally proceeded far enough so there was no basis for the old-style democratic social revolution that eliminated feudalism or semi-feudalism in the countryside. And yet the working class was far too disorganized for there to be the possibility of a socialist revolution. The democratic social revolution was a matter of the past, the socialist revolution the matter of the future, still in existence. This affects the character of these movements, where over and over again, the resulting regimes are disappointment. In these struggles, the working class may fight, but is politically disorganized, as it is around the world. Nowhere in the world yet does the working class lead such struggles. So the result of these struggles, if these struggles are successful, is that the political situation might open up to this or that extent, but the regimes will even carry out market fundamentalist measures. The masses may achieve some political rights, but not economic liberation. So these are not the grand liberating revolutions of one dreams, but they're liberalizations with the possibility of an intensified class struggle taking place. Does this mean that these struggles are useless? Not from the Marxist standpoint. For Marxism, the class struggle is the path towards organizing the working class and preparing for socialist revolution. From the point of view of utopianism, these struggles have failed. From the point of view of helping the working class organize, these struggles are essential. If one really believes that the working class and mass revolution are the motors of history, then these struggles are our struggles. These struggles are our comrades. If one disregards these struggles, one becomes a utopian, or worse, an unwitting backer of rival imperialisms. This situation has been a test of the political stance and theoretical views of the various trends in the left. Some supported these struggles when they thought they had the possibility of bringing the liberation of the working class. The Trotskyists, for example, had to do this as part of their theory of so-called permanent revolution. Various of these groups declared that these struggles either had to bring the working class to power or they would accomplish nothing. Such declarations might appear exciting at the height of the mass upsurge, but they lead to fits of depression as these struggles continue and disappoint the Trotskyist groups. The Trotskyist theory had a marked utopian flavor, either full liberation now or forget it. Let's also look at the standpoint of an ordinary pure Democrat. I know this doesn't sound like a very radical thing to consider, but it's instructive. Marvin Bashawa is a senior political analyst at Al Jazeera, and he wrote a book called The Invisible Arab, The Promise and Peril of the Arab Revolution. This book is an expression of a certain stage of the Arab awakening, namely the period of democratic euphoria, and he is passionate about what he calls today's revolution and how it's completing the previous wave of struggles. In his terms, it is liberating the people, while he says the earlier struggles liberated the land. He has no idea that the class, social, and political alliances that are bringing the Arab Spring are inevitably going to break down and lead to a period of struggles, haggling, and popular depression, nor does he realize how serious is the threat of very horrible setbacks, such as periods of fundamentalist government. He has no idea that democracy and liberalization lead to class struggle, and that the more thorough the democracy and the more successful the working class in utilizing this democracy, the more intense the resulting struggles. From the standpoint of the political trend I support, it was clear from the start that in the Arab Spring, everywhere different class factions opposed the old regimes. Everywhere different class interests were represented in the movement. It was also clear that these struggles did not have an anti-imperialist banner, and that the need to resort to a certain amount of Western imperialist military support was a danger to them. We neither glorified their nature as the great revolution, nor were we disillusioned when the mixed nature of the results of these struggles become apparent. We continue to expose Western imperialist motives, but we also recognize the legitimacy of the insurgent people utilizing differences among the foreign powers. This mixed situation is characteristic of the struggles of today. The working class today is disorganized and in crisis around the world. The working masses are divided by a multitude of differences. In this situation, the major struggles that break out are not dominated by a revolutionary viewpoint. But to abandon these struggles means to make a mockery of belief in the class struggle. So we have a choice. Either utopianism, abstaining from all struggle until somehow the one great revolutionary struggle appears, or knowing where the working class interest lies in these struggles, and using these struggles to have the working class learn the interests and features of the different classes and becomes class conscious. But non-class anti-imperialism judges these struggles not by their effect on the masses, but on how they affect the relations between the different imperialist powers. It doesn't realize the temporary gains or losses this or that big power, or this or that multinational corporation, may be the most minor aspect of the struggle. The main aspect is how far these struggles open a pathway to the class struggle. Moreover, the non-class anti-imperialists also misunderstand the nature of imperialism today. It's not enough to say that imperialism still exists today. One has to be able to see what's changed in the world situation and how the basic features of imperialism remain despite this. Several of these changes are of particular importance of today. For the sake of brevity, let's deal with just one, the rise of new imperial powers. The non-class anti-imperialists believe that only countries which were imperialist a century ago can still be imperialist today. They ignore the rise of new imperialist powers and would-be imperialist powers. They may look toward the governments of the BRICS, Brazil, Russia, India, China, and South Africa, as some type of bulwark against U.S. imperialism. But the working masses of the BRICS face the opposition of the governments and bourgeoisies of these countries. This has been dramatized by what happened at the latest of the annual meetings of the BRICS governments, this time in Durban, South Africa, late last month. Activists from the social movements in South Africa organized the BRICS from below countersummit against the BRICS from above meeting of BRICS governments. One of the main organizers of this countersummit was the South African activist Patrick Bond, who described the BRICS countries as sub-imperialists, not anti-imperialists. He described in detail examples of how these countries join in world imperialism and act like imperialists. Now, it's not just the BRICS bourgeoisies who have gone in imperialists. Any bourgeoisie of a country which has some advantages allowing it to exercise influence has sought to become its own imperialist power and join the dance of the big powers. The strategic position oil money of the Arab world has financed these imperialist strivings in the larger or more powerful countries in that region. Failing to recognize the new imperialisms and backing one imperialist or regional capitalist power as another is a travesty of anti-imperialism. We live in the most powerful imperialist country, which is still the world's only superpower. But the only way to undermine U.S. imperialism is to build support for the development of working class struggle around the world. What aids this ultimately aids the anti-imperialist struggle. What aids other imperialist powers seeking to hold down the working class retards this.
Thank you. And Larry.
Well, what should we think about imperialism? Let's start with what it has done to Iraq over the last 10 years. We need the theoretical, and especially living in this country that has created so much murder and mayhem all over the world, we need a visceral sense of what imperialism is. In Iraq, over 120,000 people killed directly in the war. 1.2 to 1.4 million people have died since 2003, the invasion. Over 4 million wounded and injured. Over 4.5 million driven from their homes. Some of you may have heard some of this before, but I think living in the belly of the beast, we have to be living with this every day. And understand what this has done to the people of the world. What about the situation of women in Iraq? Constitutionally worse, a secular constitution replaced by Sharia law. 2 million widows. An epidemic of violence against women that's more and more institutionalized. In Fallujah, there's a rate of malformation of children that's greater than Hiroshima, due to the white phosphorus and the depleted uranium weapons that have been used in Fallujah beginning in 2004. There's a torture and degradation of thousands and thousands of Iraqis in U.S.-run prisons, and then the U.S. fostering of a reactionary, sectarian civil war by the government that it put in power under Maliki, that's included torture using electric drills, massive ethnic cleansing, secret U.S. support for death squads, the so-called Salvador option, as Rumsfeld put it. And this follows, 12 years of economic sanctions, 13 years of economic sanctions that I saw firsthand when I traveled to Iraq and saw children starving to death or dying from diarrhea and not a goddamn Western cameraman in sight. I was walking around with a camera. I documented. Of course, this wasn't something shown on U.S. television. And what we're describing here in Iraq, we could discuss any country around the world, especially from West Africa all the way to Afghanistan, and the horrors that imperialism is raining down or preparing to rain down on the people of the world. And then we can talk about the fact that 22,000 children die every single year, that there's a global sex trafficking industry feasting on and despoiling and based on rape of millions of women a year. There's the destruction of the environment. There's the global horrors of poverty. All this is a product of imperialism. And, you know, I just want to say, the single greatest obstacle to humanity today is imperialism. It's a system of imperialism, particularly U.S. imperialism. And the single greatest thing that we could do for humanity is overthrow U.S. imperialism at the soonest possible moment and usher in a world free of imperialism, or begin that process. What is imperialism? To be clear, the invasion of Iraq was not Bush's war, as so many thought. It wasn't fought for corporations. It wasn't fought for the military-industrial complex. It wasn't a question of an erroneous policy based on faulty intelligence. This was a war of imperialism, a war fought to further the interests of a global empire of plunder and exploitation, rooted in the dynamics of accumulating capital on a global scale. The U.S. maintains a global empire with a home base in the United States. The U.S. state is the embodiment, personification, and enforcer of that global empire. That's the point of it. And whatever, whoever's in power, as we've seen with Obama, that's the function and role of the U.S. state, is to maintain this global system of empire. This is a system that requires the exploitation of markets, labor, and resources globally. This is a system that is based on the great division, and this is something I don't agree with James on. There's a great division and a fundamental production relation of domination and control of the vast majority of humanity in the oppressed countries or colonial or third world countries by the imperialist powers. Yes, is there complexity? Is there development within that? Are there certain countries like China that are that relationship is evolving? Yes, they are, but we can't ever forget that that is a production relation that is foundational to the entire way the world works. And on this, Lenin is excellent, and he doesn't oversimplify all of this. I'm not going to get into the relevance of Lenin today or respond to all this. But one thing that Lenin pointed out that I think is very, that this wasn't just a technical manual on imperialism. This was a polemic written by Lenin against social chauvinism and capitulation in the name of the fatherland and basing yourselves on bourgeoisified sections of the working class rather than those who hungered and yearned for revolution. This is why, I mean, the Second International was brought up here. This is an international of betrayal and capitulation who sided with their own imperialists in World War I and helped lead the slaughter of millions of people. Lenin was the only one that broke from this and refused to go along with Kautsky's capitulation and traitorous betrayal to the people of the world. And this is a lesson that we have to learn very well here, because we have to understand every single thing about this society is steeped in and infused with a parasitism that comes from U.S. position around the world and U.S. domination. I'm not arguing there isn't tons of oppression in this country. There is, especially among black people. The situation of women is terrible. There's tremendous amount of poverty. We know this. But nonetheless, the thinking, the social relations, the class relations are stamped, as Lenin put it, with a seal of parasitism from imperialism. So I think that one of the key things that we have to do, what our responsibility is to point this out, to counteract this, to fight for the orientation that the whole world comes first, not the workers in this country, not my union, not our struggle in any particular place, but the whole world comes first, and American lives are no more precious than other people's lives. And there should be right now thousands and thousands of people in the street denouncing the torture of people in Guantanamo and supporting the hunger strike those prisoners are on right now, even as they're being force-fed by the United States. And I think we have to argue for the fact that there's no such thing as humanitarian intervention, whatever. This is a complete oxymoron. How can you have humanitarian imperialist intervention? Because that's what it is. and you can look at any of the countries, including Iraq, where this was done, including what was done with the Kurds, and you'll find out every single thing that the United States has done around the world is in service of perpetuating this empire of exploitation and plunder, of rivalry with other imperialist or wannabe imperialist powers, of seeking strategic advantage and maintaining control of various regions of the world, which of course is why the U.S. is now threatening Iran. So whatever, whoever the U.S. is invading, the people in this country, it's silly and ridiculous to say, well, gee, I was against Iraq, that was a mistake, but I think the U.S. could do some good in Afghanistan. Bullshit. No. They're going for, what, all of a sudden they change the nature of the imperialist system because of what you want them to do, or hope they do, or think they'll do? No. The other thing we have to confront is the question of the rise of Islamic fundamentalism as a force that's clashing with the United States, particularly in the Middle East, Central Asia, particularly since the oh, I have 10 more minutes? Great. since the collapse of the Soviet Union. And what we're seeing, and I'm not going to, Bob Avakian, the chairman of the Revolutionary Communist Party, made a very important analysis of this, situating this as outmoded reactionary strata, one in the imperialist countries, one in the oppressed countries, country like Iran. But neither, both being reactionary, while being clear that obviously on a world scale, imperialism wreaks far more, far more havoc than even the Islamic fundamentalists, but that these two outmodeds are both reactionary, their clash between each other actually fuels a dynamic in which if you support one, you're strengthening the other. If you side with either one, you're strengthening both of them. And this is a dynamic we urgently have to break out of. And the way we have to break out of this is through revolution. And both of the other panelists have really not talked about revolution in any substantial way or treated it as a very distant prospect. But this is a powerful system, but it's riven with deep contradictions. And revolutions are possible based on those profound contradictions, based on the fact that this system is in utter antagonism to the interests of the vast majority of people, and also based on the path-breaking work Avakian has done in summing up the very important and liberatory first wave of communism from Marx through Mao. Summing that up, both its great strengths and lessons, but also its shortcomings and weaknesses, and brought forward, and even grievous errors, and brought forward a new synthesis of communism, as well as a strategy for making revolution right here in the belly of the beast. Yes, U.S. imperialism. And I don't have time to elaborate this, the entire strategy that the RCP has developed, and but I, number one, recommend people see the film B.A. Speaks, Revolution, Nothing Less, which I believe, I guess they have to move the tables out, so they're outside. I'd recommend people see that. I would recommend that people take a look at the Constitution for the New Socialist Republic of North America draft proposal, which is a thoroughly internationalist document, which makes the argument that there's no genuine liberatory communist revolution that doesn't proceed from internationalism and the whole world comes first. So this constitution calls for, after the seizure of power and the institution of a revolutionary state, a revolutionary dictatorship of the proletariat, the immediate dismantling of U.S. bases all over the world, the immediate breaking of all trade and economic relations, and restructuring those relations with people all over the world, with making every economic decision on the basis of advancing the world revolution, meeting the needs of people here, and protecting the world's environment. And one of the key parts of the strategy, for revolution is changing thinking and changing action. And in terms of changing action, we vigorously oppose all U.S. interventions, sanctions, threats, bullying all around the world. I'd encourage people to read our newspaper, Revolution at Revcom.us, and at the same time train people, from the people locked in ghettos at the bottom of this society to middle class and people well off, in the spirit of internationalism and in the spirit that American lives don't come first, the planet comes first. Thank you.
Thank you, everyone. I might come in a little bit later, but I feel like there might be questions out in the audience that I can take. So I will ask, Gregor?
I would like you to go, the three of you, to go more into the role of the bourgeoisie today as opposed to the late 19th, early 20th century. And that the way I understand it, at least, is that the bourgeoisie under Bonapartism had really given up political power so as to keep up economic power. And that the period of imperialism around the 20th century really also saw the merging of those two aspects again within the bourgeoisie. I wonder what you would think of that today in terms of the bourgeoisie and how it is, what role it plays, whether nationally, internationally, multinationally, transnationally, so whether imperialism still operates from a poor nation-state basis.
Respond in the opposite direction?
Yes, the state is, we're not, imperialism isn't capitalism detached from the state, detached from its base, detached from the military and machinery that enforces imperialism around the world. This is sometimes argued, as you know, that the state's disappearing, now we just have global capital unmoored from the state. That isn't true. For example, in Iraq, Halliburton didn't invade. The U.S. military invaded. The second thing, and you know, just briefly, is that so this is an imperialism that's global but still very much anchored in the nation state, and hence the actions of the U.S. around the world. Even though imperialist rivalry between different states isn't as pronounced as it was, say, during the Cold War, when the social imperialist Soviet Union was in contention with the United States, it exists nonetheless. The other thing I just want to say briefly on the question of the bourgeoisie, of course, in the imperialist countries has no progressive role whatsoever to play any place in the world. Nothing for it. And in the oppressed countries, what's been shown is that to achieve liberation, the bourgeoisie cannot lead that struggle. The proletariat, led by a vanguard communist party, based on the science of communism, is what's necessary to lead that, as Mao showed in one of the greatest revolutions of human history, and the most, and then afterward, the most liberatory and highest pinnacle of the communist revolution that's existed today. Now, the Chinese Revolution, as I mentioned, was led by a vanguard, but there was a role that was played by the national bourgeoisie and other elements of the bourgeoisie in that revolution, but led by the proletariat, not led by the program of the bourgeoisie. And what's been shown historically is that if these revolutions or upheavals or coups are led by the bourgeoisie, it's impossible to break the chains that are, you know, most strangling these oppressed countries: imperialism, feudalism, and thank you very much. My time's up.
I'm sorry, but I somehow missed the thread of your question. You were asking about the bourgeoisie in the oppressed countries or the oppressor countries.
in general, the way and the role of the bourgeoisie in imperialism, in conducting imperialism.
I mean, I can take another question, and then you can answer.
In a certain respect, I agree with Larry. I don't share his high assessment of Mao's China, but in that respect, it seems to me it's straightforwardly true that it's where you genuinely have had a situation where national liberation movements ever haven't ended up simply in semi-colonial countries, is when you have had what's one sort of communist party or another that's armed to the teeth. Taking charge. It tells us the historic failure of Stalinism. And those things have ended up leading equally to nowhere on the longer timescales, which is the problematic. The bourgeoisie as a kind of other thing is that obviously there is a distinction between the bourgeoisie as a class and the bourgeois state regime and system of bourgeois state regimes and is in that sense imperialism. But nonetheless, it is the state regime of bourgeois. There are innumerable ways in which the capitalist class sets limits and enforces, in that sense, positive policy on the state regimes, ranging from simple kind of elaboration, sort of implication with the bureaucracy, in some cases obviously straightforward bribery to indirect bribery of the media apparatus, the advertising subsidies, and something that large scale capital operating in the media. I don't think the role of the bourgeoisie has changed in imperialism as such. But what has changed as historical circumstances have changed, how that has happened to play out has been transformed. But the role of the bourgeoisie in all this has always been, it's a necessary feature for them to be successful in their exploitation.
I see Richard looks desperate at the back to say something, so I'll take this.
Well, I guess I had a series of fairly specific historical questions for everybody. One is, I'm curious how people would regard the Second World War. Would any of you have supported the Allied side? And if so, why is that not an imperialist war, and what would be the meaning of that? And I guess I'm also curious, particularly from James Turley, but how you perceive certain important non-state actors, such as the UN and the EU, are those imperialist institutions, the United Nations and the EU? And I guess, I'm also curious about how you perceive, for example, the Arab Spring was mentioned in the Middle East, And one country that is often seen as a classic example of sub-imperialism, of course, is Israel. Yet, I mean, one of the things that's interesting is, for example, in 1948, most of the left, including the communist movement of the Soviet Union, supported the creation of Israel. So I'm curious whether you would see, for example, the various wars that happened between Israel and various Arab states as anti-imperialist wars on the Arab side that should have been supported, or whether you'd have a critical attitude towards both sides. So I'm just sort of curious about more specific questions. And also, there seemed to be a difference in that some of the people were emphasizing inter-imperialist rivalry, whereas the speaker from the RCP seemed to think that there really wasn't any inter-imperialist rivalry anymore, and that basically the U.S. ran everything.
David, do you want to answer this?
Okay. Begin with regard to the Second World War. The Allied imperialists obviously were still imperialists and still had imperialist motives, and when they had the chance, they crushed the liberation movements they temporarily allied with. However, the working class did have an interest in the issue of defeat of the fascist powers. So it provided a complicated question. There was an interest in defeating the fascist powers. They should have been more vigilant with regard to the imperialist interests of the Allies. With regard to the non-state actors such as the UN, the EU, etc., I think that's an extremely important point, because I think the UN precisely is a world imperialist agency that represents the interests of the leading imperialist powers. So sometimes I'm astonished when people say, oh, you know, we're against what's going on, say, this or that in the Arab country, but the UN says otherwise. But what do you think the UN is? Whose interests does it represent? Whose interests does Ban Ki-moon represent? So yes, these are imperialist agencies. As to Israel, the Soviet Union supported the creation of Israel as part of a very corrupt deal for the sake of it thought that it could throw British imperialism out of its position in Palestine. So it could portray anything for that reason. As example, in fact, Stalin was the leader of a state capitalist country carrying out an imperialist policy. And with that single act, he stabbed in the back just about every communist activist in the Middle East and created tremendous difficulties for them.
Okay, thank you. Larry?
Okay. Number one, I was trying to make the opposite point, that there is inter-imperialist rivalry, although perhaps not as pronounced. I think you misheard that. Second, look, I have fundamental disagreements with both panelists on the question of really the whole first wave of communist revolution, beginning in 1917, but then after Lenin's death and with Stalin's rise to power, and especially around Mao and the Chinese Revolution. We've not time for a long discussion of that. I would love to get into it, and the RCP's written quite a bit on this. But I just want to make this very clear. And we've critiqued Stalin, but upheld him in a broad sense as a revolutionary and not a state capitalist country. I want to make that clear. But having said that, one of the key elements of Bob Avakian's new synthesis, which applies especially to Stalin, but also to some degree of Mao, revolves around the question of internationalism. In other words, any socialist state is faced with a contradiction between advancing the world revolution on one hand and maintaining state power when you're being assaulted by imperialists from all sides. This is a very acute contradiction. And let's make criticisms of Stalin fine, but realize what he was up against in the Nazis. And that doesn't justify errors. I'm not saying that. So this line that both the agreement with the British to found Israel and the whole conduct of World War II represented a subordination of the world revolution to the needs of state power in the Soviet Union, as real and legitimate as those were. But it was an incorrect subordination of the world revolution. We can look at Greece, we can look at a lot of other examples to the needs and even an identification of whatever advanced the interests of the Soviet Union with the advance of the world revolution, and that isn't true. And so this is the way that Avakian's thinking has gone much further. And I would just say that the state of Israel is a client state and an embodiment of imperialist interests in the Middle East, a settler colonial state that has no legitimacy whatsoever and is based on the ethnic cleansing of Palestine and should be resolutely opposed, and the masses rising up against Israel support it. And look, this is a key responsibility we have in this country, is to expose and oppose the state of Israel, not because of the Zionist lobby and so on, but going back to our discussion, Israel's supported by the United States because it serves imperialist interests, not because the Zionists have a powerful lobby in Washington, D.C. And so this is part of exposing U.S. imperialism, is exposing the crimes of Israel.
Thank you. James?
Okay, I mean, in terms of bribery and something doing bribery. It, you know, it is a feature, but it just has the truth in that sense is sort of complicated in between, you think, because there is a dominant power. You know, there is rivalry, but there is no rival to the US at the moment. The European Union is not able to marshal military forces in a way they could inflict a defeat on America. China, possibly in another 30 years, and again, Europe maybe soon, but at the moment, no. No one, that's the thing, that's the fundamental what we're dealing with. The matter of Israel and kind of Arab wars, I guess. Well, in that sense, the Soviets' angle to that, or rather the Cold War angle to this, is crucial. I mean, we've been through the sort of the business of 1948 and groups or whatever, like Shachtman's group, Workers' Party, who would have thought themselves actually hated Stalinism, are still working in an environment, in a political environment where like the left-wing positions are partially emanate from the power of the official communist movement. So it isn't surprising that that is the... And then Israel presents itself in leftish forms, in leftish face of the world at the time, you know, with the kibbutzim and all that kind of thing. As far as the wars, concretely, some of these regimes were fighting against Israel, very, very reactionary in themselves, and actually have become client states of the United States. So it's more complicated when you look at things like Egypt and, I guess, Syria and sort of the kind of Ba'athist, various forms of Arab nationalism. But fundamentally, this is about these people are in the kind of Soviet sphere of influence, so you end up with this kind of socialistic form of nationalism, which actually end up later is the same people who transform themselves into a straightforward, in that sense, a state capitalist, if you will, bourgeoisie. That's clear what the situation and environment regime is in by the time it fell. It's sort of more common. It's clear that that these social forces can only be anti-imperialist to a certain point. Actually, that's made very clear. Like, when I was reporting, Israel is essentially a colonial state, abolished. I agree with the panelists on that one. International bodies, EU, UN. Well, what these are crystallizations of relations of forces on a global level, both economic and military. So in that, they are both a tool in this modern situation. The UN in particular is effectively a tool. A tool of the US-led state order in order to maintain that in certain ways. So, it's clear who runs things. And the EU is kind of more complicated because more hegemonic forces within it represent potential rivals to the US hegemony, but it nonetheless is a kind of local expression of the balance of forces, which is why it's kind of a little bit, you get lefties who think that everything in Greece will be sold if they leave the EU. It's like, that's not the point. The EU isn't domination itself. It's an aspect. It's tied in with it, and it sort of reflects it. World War II is an inter-imperialist war to an extent. There is a technical problem, which is that the Soviet Union was non-capitalist, whatever you call it, and wasn't imperialist in a straightforward sense. In that sense, it's a part of a more longer-term kind of historical process, and we are dealing with the kind of historic failure to turn the crisis of British hegemony into a revolution. But in that sense, it could be a global revolution of the system. I don't think it's an easy answer to like huge side with what Trotsky is interested in.
Can you say a little more on this? Is that...
Can I take one more question and maybe
respond?
Mine is a bit in sort of bringing it to more contemporary situation. I think one of the motivations for this panel is the anniversary of the 10 years of the Iraq War, and you realize that the three people on the panel actually have the book Communists in the title of their organizations or publications. And one of the questions for this panel that I remember sort of briefly reading is the question of assessing whether or not the anti-war movement against the war in Iraq actually moved the working class towards the communist or the struggle towards socialism. And the answer, I think, in the context of the CPTP was no, it did not manage to do that. I'm not sure how you two would answer that question, but if it's only now, if the answer is definitely no, I think that 5 years ago it was definitely something people had not answered no. Now, has there been enough distance that we can assess the why? Why was it that the anti-war movement, you know, millions strong in multiple cities across the world, the anti-war Iraq movement, why has it now not been able to actually build a movement towards socialism, a working class, proletariat, class conscious struggle for socialism? Why was it unable to do that, in your estimation?
Sure. Just one thing off the last thing. Look, the term Stalinism is just an anti-communist, anti-revolutionary shorthand taking advantage of bourgeois anti-communism that posits communism as about a totalitarian dictatorship. And in case I wasn't clear, the Soviet Union, led by Stalin, I was pointing out some errors in their foreign policy, but on the part of the Soviet Union and Stalin, that was a tremendously heroic and just war to defeat the Nazis, which, if anybody's watched Oliver Stone's series, you'll understand that that's who did it, nobody else. So I want to make that clear, and I think that abandoning this first wave and just really accepting the bourgeois imperialist summation of the first wave of communism is one of the greatest betrayals of the people of this world, because this was an incredibly valuable and liberatory experience that has to, yes, be built on and synthesized further. We have to go farther and do better, but we are not going to do that if we reject the lessons and the victories of the greatest movement for emancipation that's ever existed in human history. And so, and it relates to the topic here at Platypus. The question isn't utopia, as in hopeless dreams versus just being buried in present-day realpolitik. What this new synthesis of Baba Bakin's is visionary and viable, emancipatory and scientific, and it's founded on studying this experience as well as much other experience. But I think that's really crucial, because if we're talking about imperialism, let's talk about getting rid of imperialism. And speaking of imperialism, the EU is an imperialist institution. The UN is an imperialist institution. France intervening.
Gary, I would like to actually try to address this through the.
I am. I'm going to. But look, let's have some actual. You know, let's get into some substance here. What the real differences are, and so is the United Nations and French intervention in Mali. In terms of the your point about the upheaval and the mass 15 million people, new superpower in 2003. I think that that showed the potential, the depths of people's hatred of a lot of what was going on. But it also showed that that has to be led by a revolutionary vanguard party, that people spontaneously, even if they're opposed to a particular action of the ruling class, do not spontaneously understand, you know, what's driving this, what's the solution to this, and the sacrifices and struggle that are needed in order to overcome this. And I think a particularly important thing is the revolutionary movement that I'm talking to has to be rooted in those the society has cast off. I was in San Francisco. I was at that demonstration. And afterward, I think what happened is a lot of people got sucked into the illusions of U.S. democracy, that if you simply get rid of Bush or vote for Kerry, as people did in 2004, that somehow things were changed. They didn't understand what we're talking about today, that, you know, what exists in the U.S. isn't democracy, it's capitalism, imperialism, and political structures that support that. I think the other thing that you know people don't want to face intellectually and in terms of their activity is what is it actually going to take to go up against U.S. imperialism. And I think that was also a factor in people coming out in their millions in a very important protest that showed a lot of potential, including globally, but it wasn't carried through. I mean, I do want to commend and uphold the work of World Can't Wait, drive out the Bush regime at that time. Now World Can't Wait in terms of trying to lead this upheaval in a way that really changed the whole political terrain, short of revolution, but change the political terrain as part of preparing for revolution.
Okay, can I get Joseph?
I think the anti-war movement played a tremendous role with regard to motivating the left. In my own case, it was the war in Vietnam played a very important role by becoming a communist. The desire to defeat U.S. imperialism, to find a force that would defeat U.S. imperialism, and a way to do that. With regard to the struggle against the war in Iraq, I don't think it's a flaw in the struggle against the war in Iraq why things haven't moved further. I think that it's a very serious issue that the working class is disorganized, that the trade unions almost everywhere are class collaborationists. The political parties, which you'd expect to support the working class, don't. For example, the Socialist International had relations with the Mubarak regime until just before it fell, and then Ali in Tunisia had relations with the Socialist International. Now, we did, people here would look to the Socialist International, and many workers would. There's a great deal of disorganization that exists, and the anti-war movement by itself couldn't overcome that. Now it's not just a matter of people's desire when the struggle grows to a certain level. There's certain objective conditions. So, from my point of view, I think the anti-war movement did play a tremendous role. The people who took part in will remember this, but that it alone could, one struggle alone can't necessarily change the whole situation.
What I would like to push you guys on a little bit is which is to follow on from Laurie's question, which is to having recognized that the anti-war movement didn't succeed in what it was doing, what I'm wondering is if it actually contributed to a furthering of confusion about what it means to be anti-imperialist today.
Well, I'm confused by that, but no.
In terms of how to respond to present conflicts in Syria and Libya.
Well,
James?
It's clear that going on demonstrations against the war in Libya and the war in Syria was a pretty depressing experience in Britain. There'd be 200 or 300 people outside an embassy, and half of them would be vigorously pro-Assad types, very, very dubious politics indeed. And the other half would be kind of liberal Iranians, and they were like getting into fights, physical fights. That was a far cry from 2003 when we had 1.5 million people out on the street. I mean, the thing is, it was a kind of enormous opportunity, and in that sense, it still is a terrible, a terrible thing to say. But the fact that the sort of endless conflagrations here, there, and everywhere keep arising, there will be another anti-war movement on that scale as long as they keep having these bloody wars. It's an error on the part of the left in Britain that it didn't realise that the situation had changed after 2003, after the troops went in, because in the run up to that it was clear that large parts of the international bourgeoisie for their own reasons thought that this wasn't a good idea. And this is why you had all the stuff about UN resolutions, and the French had certain interests with Iraq and this, that, and the other. There was a these people were bashing heads with each other, which meant it was actually easier than it was ever going to be again to get through and just as Joseph was saying earlier, kind of take advantage of this like little moment, and you had this enormous demonstration. But no, after that, the movement just they had this sort of image in their head that they just got more people out the next time, the more people out the next time. And really what needed to be done was to get across the fundamental, start arguing that there could have been 3 million of us, and they would have still have done it. They would have still have done it, my comrade Mark Minard, as to say, unless there was a real, MPs of Britain who would be in fear of their lives if they just hung from lampposts by their constituents if they voted for the war. In the absence of that, you do need a serious revolutionary poll on that, and people, and that was never grasped. So yes, this was a real opening, a real opportunity. It was the it will. It's not gone completely, confusion. I think the confusion stems from other things, but partly from other things, which will maybe.
The revolutionary communists weren't confused in the sense that unless you overthrow imperialism, A, wars are going to continue, and B, no mass movement is going to sustain itself in the way that perhaps some people expected. If you expect to, take a spontaneous struggle, and let's put it this way, for this was a very broad section of the middle class and the masses of people that came out, but it was a spontaneous struggle. And the notion that you're going to simply take that spontaneous uprising and gradually push it toward revolution is what may have confused some people. I think it's important, the RCP strategy, which is in Basics, and I would highly recommend people read the strategy for revolution, is seizing on all of these kind of outbreaks and crises in order to more broadly plant the pole of revolutionary communism and to raise the organization and consciousness of the masses of people that anything less than revolution is bullshit, isn't going to change anything that we're protesting. And while this wasn't a revolutionary crisis that exists, that took place on February 15th that you're talking about, it certainly showed the potential for millions and millions of people to be drawn into political life very quickly. But the key there is, have the revolutionaries accumulated enough force, the forces that can actually lead that in a revolutionary direction if you are in a revolutionary crisis? And then when millions of people are determined not to live in the same way and the rulers are divided and so on, you actually have the prospect of going for state power, which is ultimately the only thing that's going to stop this. But certainly wars are a concentration of imperialism and something that we should expose, and where they come from and why revolution and an entirely different economic and political system are needed. I do also want to just point out that one of the things the bourgeoisie did in response to this uprising was Barack Obama, whose mission was not to change what the ruling class was doing, but to bamboozle the masses into passivity. And I'm not saying it was simply Obama, but that was the chief mission of the Obama administration. Electing, putting Obama in power was rebranding imperialism and, quieting this growing. There was tremendous hatred of Bush, and it was beginning to, in many ways, you could see the seeds of a legitimacy crisis there, which didn't emerge. So.
Thank you.
We have like 5 more minutes, so can I take maybe 2 more questions or 1 more?
Yeah, so quickly for all 3 panelists, I'll be starting over here. Do you think that the oppressed peoples of Libya, be it the working class or the peasants, would have been better off had the Western left been able to prevent NATO military intervention?
I'm against NATO military intervention in Libya. I don't know, you know, I'm not a supporter of the Gaddafi regime. Raymond Lotta wrote a very excellent article on this in Revolution. But, you know, the NATO intervention was an intervention of imperialism to put pro-U.S. reactionaries in power, killed many, many people. That isn't to say the people of Libya, if the masses of people had been involved in a genuine struggle for liberation, and I'm sure there were individuals who were out there fighting against Gaddafi who had those feelings. But if you look at the movement overall, it was very much influenced by imperialism from the beginning. But certainly, the RCP, protested and opposed NATO intervention in Libya.
The movement in Libya was not a creation of foreign powers. It was an upsurge of the Libyan people who have been suppressed for decades, no free trade unions, no free political life. Many of these people, even their national identity was denied. The Berber people in Libya were being compulsorily turned into Arabs, and their national identity denied. The Libyan uprising was a genuine uprising. The Libyan uprising prevented massive intervention on the ground. It took a U.S. air intervention. Without that air intervention, the likelihood is they would have been drowned in blood in Benghazi and elsewhere. The intervention, our task is always to expose the imperialist motives of our government. We know the U.S. government didn't do this out of humanitarian motives, but it was legitimate for the Libyan people to utilize this contradiction among the imperialists. Almost no revolution in the world has ever succeeded unless the foreign enemies were divided. And it's astonishing that a person who defends the Soviet Union taking massive U.S., British, and French aid in World War II will deny the Libyan people the right to have freedom with a certain alliance. That said, it makes a complicated political situation, and it's one of the reasons why the anti-war movement gets disoriented is a just, legitimate feeling on the part of activists who wanted to not denounce anything the U.S. does completely. If anyone worked with U.S. imperialism at all, they must be horrible. That's a certain noble feeling on the part of activists. And so when you have a situation where you simply can't take that stand that way, it creates confusion, and it does. But it's better that the Libyan uprising succeeded, and the situation in Libya is far better that the uprising has succeeded than if Gaddafi had continued to rule.
So you're supporting the air intervention, just so I understand.
I said what I wanted to say. Continue on to.
Well, in that sense, I disagree with you. So, I mean, it's kind of the results of this, I think it's sort of too early to tell, but there are unpromising signs. What we have had is the same kind of, like, this parachuting in of a government which doesn't really seem to have, in that sense, power in the country. I don't see that what's coming out of this is a stable state regime, and already you have the signs, like, in very accelerated form. You know, it took about, 10 years before Hamid Karzai started legalizing marital rape and things. This is already happening in Libya. It's a kind of complicated. I mean, there's no way around it. People, people did die because NATO blew them up. But that uprising would have been crushed by Gaddafi. But there could have been another one. It's clear that the problem is we're not learning the lessons of the way that the things like, on the basis of how things have panned out in Somalia and then Iraq, and then Afghanistan and then Iraq, what's clear is that the US-led international imperialist order is increasingly unable to impose a state regime, even in the kind of sense of serving its interests. There's all that stuff about, Iraq is a war for on oil, so we could have lots of cheap oil. Well, hasn't the price of gas has just returned to its finally dropped to the price that it was in 2003, and it's because the in order to maintain kind of any sort of control on the ground, they've had to, in that sense, decompose the society. And that's why I think it's extremely, as we were talking earlier, I think this is kind of a manifestation of the euphoria of the Arab Spring, I think, sort of maybe led people to think that was just the way that we're just going to sweep everything. And it's clear that that's not happened, that we're in a fairly bad phase of it at the moment, if you look at what's happening in Egypt and things like that as well. So absolutely, I think it would have been better. It wouldn't be better in the short run, but in the long run.
I'm completely puzzled by that response. I mean, first of all, you seem to be opposed to the intervention because they didn't impose a successful puppet regime. I mean, you said there's no stable.
Well,
I'm totally baffled. I understood the other two speakers.
I
don't understand
their position. Better, tyranny or chaos? And my judgment is that we'll end up with chaos.
But if so you were opposed to it because it didn't work, or because you're opposed? I mean, I don't understand your position. I understood the other two speakers. Politically. You just opposed it a priori? I mean,
I oppose it because the judgment was, in that sense, what comes out of it will be some kind of in that sense, puppet regime with a very, very sort of limited sphere of influence, and then just kind of decomposition. Look at the kind of broader pattern of what's happening in the Middle East. You know, it's already ridiculously divided into these competing little states, and they're going to be divided again because this is as a result of this wave. And you know, Libya is very much part of this wave of imperialist interventions in the region. You can't. I don't believe in boxing these things off.
I mean, we're out of time. Could I have like 1 minute each to say their final remarks?
You're writing the show.
Yeah. Okay. Would people like to give final remarks for one minute each? Larry.
1 minute as we are spinning toward a black hole, which equals 20 years. First of all, both panelists supported imperialist intervention in Libya. I think it's outrageous that they've done this.
I didn't support imperialist intervention in Libya. I just got taken up for doing so and not doing so, and it confused well.
Well, okay. It sounded like you were, but that's okay. If you're not, I'm glad to hear it. But I think one thing, and just in terms of this humanitarian intervention, and I think he clearly did, in terms of humanitarian intervention, it isn't just the havoc wreaked in any particular country. And look, let's go back to this two outmodeds phenomenon. What has U.S. intervention done in Libya? It's not only killed and caused much suffering, it's actually fueled reactionary Islamic fundamentalism, not only in Libya, but in Mali. How's that a good outcome? So you can't just look at the immediate situation. People argue the U.S. protected the Kurds for 15 years, but why did they do it? As a base area in order to be able to overthrow the Saddam Hussein regime and lead to the deaths of other people. So this notion of humanitarian intervention, or well, in this situation, it's better than the alternative, is poison. Oops, was that longer than I meant?
Okay. First of all, no matter how many times you say I support humanitarian imperialism, it's a lie, and you know it's a lie. I specifically said we should expose the motives of what Louis Rocose was doing, and that what was existed was a contradiction among the imperialists, which the people were right to take advantage of. But the main issue is, if you want to fight imperialism, you can't just say, well, just overthrow it immediately. Well, if you could overthrow it immediately, go ahead and do it, and I would support it.
That is our strategy, by the way.
May I finish? What you have to do is support these struggles that will organize the working, help organize the working class, which over a period of time will give rise to the revolution. You have to know how to handle struggle, at the time when the revolution isn't imminent, but struggles are breaking out. That's what I tried to indicate with the example of the Arab Spring. This is not a question of the Great Revolution taking place, but it is a question of this type of struggle that advances the situation in the Middle East. Decades in which the Arab people weren't allowed to have any say in anything are being replaced by they have a say. What they say at first may not be what you want them to say, but they have to work out themselves what they're going to say.
You can't have an absolutely ridiculous, yeah, absolutely like purist, no, you know, absolutely never take anything from it, because it's simply, I do support, as it happens, part of your first wave of communist revolutions, and part of that was German imperialism putting Lenin on the train to Russia. So we can't, you know, it's in our sense, in our heritage, that dubious, slightly dubious deals here and there and everywhere. I think the problem with this is that what you ended up with is what mass initiative there was in the initial Libyan uprisings was lost. It became a NATO war. That it was simply the forces that they were sponsoring that were able to sort of take command of it. And that is as clear as what's happening in Syria as well. But forces with which the US believes it can do business, precisely Islamic fundamentalist forces, ever more and more bizarrely. That's what's in the ascendancy. So support the popular uprisings. I don't know what kind of what the tyrant happens to think of the US international regime, but we have to really understand what's going on the ground. What's going on the ground is less euphoric, shall we say, than it was in the spring of 2011.
Thank you very much.